Domestic preparedness is with Brigadier Simon Perry of the Israel National Police, who has been currently stationed here in Washington at the Israeli Embassy, where he has been instrumental in liaison with U.S. law enforcement. Among Brigadier Perry's duties is to represent Israel's law enforcement exchange program that takes U.S. law enforcement professionals to Israel for advanced counterterrorism training from the Israel National Police and Shin Bet. Today we're going to discuss, among other things, what the program teaches its students about suicide bombers, improvised explosive devices, and other threats as may pertain to the United States, and how the police forces here are preparing to counter it. Brigadier Perry, thanks for hosting us at your embassy here in Washington.
You're welcome.
Well, first I want to talk about a background a little bit to the Law Enforcement Exchange Program. Who exactly runs it? How long has it been going? And tell us a little bit more about your role here in the U.S. as it pertains to the program.
The program was initiated actually in combination with Israeli police and a few organizations. The first organization that I recall that was doing this program is JINSA, Jewish Institute mm-hmm. for National Security. And this organization has been bringing for many years generals from the U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force, and the Israeli Army together. And after 9/11, they came to the conclusion that security is also law enforcement. And about 3 years ago, we started this program. But not only JINSA brings the law enforcement together. We do programs with ADL, mm-hmm. with APAC, and the Sheriff Association. So we do have a few programs that exchange share. Experiences mm-hmm. between the United States and Israel. Of course, most of the area that we share is law enforcement, because in Israel, the responsibility for internal security is with the police. Mm-hmm. So we try to bring major city chiefs, major county sheriffs, federal people, FBI, DA, ATF, Secret Service, to Israel, to show them in a few days a seminar about how we deal with internal security in Israel. We also bring police officers from Israel to the United States for larger crowds in the United States, and we talk about the same topics.
Every year, routinely now, how many law enforcement officers go? And I think you've said their backgrounds are really from local, federal, and state. But tell us a little bit about how large the program is on a yearly basis.
Now there is a group of about 10 law enforcement officers that the ADL is in Israel this week. Mm-hmm. Next week, we're taking with the JINSA 15 colleagues. A few months ago, we had a group from the Sheriff Association that were taken by APAC to Israel. We had this year another group of JINSA. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about, I would say, 5-6 programs a year. I would say around 60 people. We're talking about heads of organizations. Mm-hmm. That's one aspect of the cooperation. But we do had seminars here in the United States. Mm-hmm. We bring police officers from Israel. A few weeks ago, there was a group, a police officer that talked to a group of law enforcement through ADL. This year with JINSA, we did several seminars. In one seminar in Ohio, we had 1,000 participants. Mm-hmm. In Long Island, we had somewhere around 600 participants.
Wow.
So it's much easier when we bring police officers here to have large audiences.
Mm-hmm. And they do several of those programs. How many days is each program like that?
The seminars are 2 days, programs. Yeah, mm-hmm. The one that we do with JINSA, the ADL is a little different. It's a smaller group but a longer program. Mm-hmm. So.
What sort of things do they learn in the programs, both in Israel and the 2-day seminars that you have here?
We we don't try to teach them anything because we don't think that the United States compares with Israel with size or the same organization. But we do share experiences, and which experiences that the American colleagues found, as far as they claim, very useful. We talk to them about our strategy, about our tactics, talk to them about the threat, talk about how we deal with the threat. It's a full program. Actually, you know, if we could have done it longer, I think the colleagues would have even appreciated longer. But we are limited. We're trying to do a program that will cover the basis elements of what we do and try to share the experiences and the lessons that we learned from our situation, because we made a lot of mistakes in Israel. Although we have 120 years terrorism, 60 years of terrorism before we had a country, what we are going through the last few years is a different situation. And unfortunately, suicide terrorism is a new phenomenon in the Middle East. Actually, the first to suffer from it were the Americans, if you remember. More than 200 Marines were killed in Beirut. And for us in Israel, it started actually, ironically, in the peace process in 93, when the peace process started. The fundamentalist extremists actually decided at that time to attack Israel. And ever since, we've been dealing with this topic. Well, the big attack started around 2000. And we did make a lot of mistakes. It took us a lot of time to learn the lessons. Unfortunately, and paying a lot of blood to learn this lesson. So we are trying to make sure that the American colleagues don't make the same mistakes that we made.
Mm-hmm. Now, will that remain the focus this year, or are you also incorporating IEDs? That no. certainly is in the news nowadays, this side.
No, we also talk about IEDs. That's one of the topics that we talk on the seminars, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we do have specific training for example, bomb squad units. We have sharing with several law enforcement. There was a colleague from Los Angeles that went to Israel, worked with our bomb squads. Afterwards, due to this experience in Iraq, and I understand it was very helpful from the American point of view. We have a very good sharing with law enforcement around United States. We have a colleague from Israel coming in the next a few weeks to Philadelphia to share some experiences. So we do have specific sharing in specific areas like bomb squads.
With the bomb squads, is that just for law enforcement squads, or do you also have a provision where if you have a fire service that has a bomb squad unit, for example, Montgomery County is one here, would you have those participating in your program?
Yes, we have a sharing not only with law enforcement. We work very closely, as you know, with, for example, with the Maryland Homeland Security, with the head of the Homeland Security in Maryland, Mr. Dennis Schrader, who is really doing a tremendous job to prepare Maryland for any event that should happen. And with this cooperation with Homeland Security, like in Maryland, like in Ohio, like in New York, and other places around the states, we have contact also to fire departments and, and other officials that deal with Homeland Security, not from the law enforcement aspect. For example, we take law enforcement and Homeland Security people to see how the Israeli hospitals, the Israeli first aid work with police, how we work together to deal with events.
One more question on the program. Anybody that's interested, be they law enforcement or a hospital or fire and rescue, that wants to know more information about the program or whether they might be able to participate, whom do they contact?
That's a little bit of a problem. As you know, Israel is a very small country. I always say that the Americans can't understand how small Israel, exactly the way that Israelis can't understand how big the United States is. You have more law enforcement organizations than we have actually almost policemen. So we are limited. We're doing the most that we can, but we are limited. And at this stage, we work with organizations. So to the program in Israel, we bring leading officials in homeland security and law enforcement that we select with assistance of the IACP, for example, right, with the Sheriff Association. So we select the people. And for the programs that we do in the United States, it's actually in combination with the departments in the United States and Homeland Security departments. So it's not, we don't take personal policemen. We just won't be able to do it. I mean, only in DHS you have around 200,000 people, and that doesn't count any other local and state law enforcement. So unfortunately, we're a little limited in who we can take and how many we can.
So if there's any senior police officials that are interested, the best thing for them to do is contact
the embassy,
they're interested in the embassy or IACP.
Yes, I think IACP.
Or NSA.
Or the Sheriff Association. They have very good contact routes, because I think they have a direct contact with us. Marianne Vivaret, the president of the IACP, a close friend of ours, and they will be excellent contact. And from Homeland Security, we have a lot of contact through the heads of Homeland Security, like I mentioned, Dennis Rader and others. Yeah.
All right, I want to turn a little bit to what we could call the tactical response to the suicide bomber and the IED threat. How is Israel evolving its lessons learned in this area? You mentioned that 1993 was when you first experienced the suicide bomber, and then it ramped up after the peace process to 2000. So you've got some lessons learned. They are evolving. Can you share some insights into those?
Of course, we have a lot, unfortunately, of insights into that. Specifically, you're talking about explosives. That's a specific person question. So we found out that most of the attacks against us were homemade explosives. And there's a lot of tactical outcomes of homemade explosives. So we try to share that with the law enforcement and our colleagues here in the United States.
Now, in light of the July 2005 attacks against the London transport system, do you see the suicide bomber threat coming to America? I mean, is this only a matter of time?
First of all, just to mention, the attacks in London were also homemade explosive. If I'm not mistaken, it was DATP. And there's a lot of things that you need to get organized when it's not regular explosives, as training issues and preparedness issues. Unfortunately, I think that the America was before England in the suicide terrorism. I think 9/11 is a very clear, or maybe the worst suicide attack. They were not using explosives, but they used big Molotov cocktails and the way of airplanes, basically exploding into with a lot of fire and creating a tremendous disaster and tragedy. So I think the Brits are following you and not ahead of you in this arena. But following your question, for terrorism, you need two things. You need motivation and you need capabilities. And unfortunately, capabilities, I'm quite convinced, are here in the United States. It's very easy to produce a terrorist attack. And, you know, you had terrorist attacks. Maybe you don't call it a terrorist attack, but you had the trucks filled up with explosives, homemade explosives, take buildings down in the United States long before 9/11.
Indeed.
So the capability is here in the United States. It's only now a question of motivation. I think that at this stage, the motivation is a rational motivation. The other side makes rational choices. And if they're not attacking the United States now, they have a clear reason not to do that. And I believe it, they want to continue the war in Iraq in a way that United States will be humiliated by taking its troops out of Iraq. And the message that they will be sending by that is to their own people, look, we the few with little weapons succeeded to humiliate the United States like we did humiliate the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And from their point of view, it won't make sense to attack the United States, because they've learned a lesson. When you attack the United States, Americans have a history of throwing rockets, missiles, and soldiers everywhere. And if they want to get you out of Iraq, they would be wise to keep things quiet here and continue fighting you in Iraq.
What about on the ground here, U.S. law enforcement, how they should be addressing it tactically, and how are we doing here, and where do we need to go? And I'm thinking in particular, you're talking about the homemade devices. I do know that Israel does, in its policing, emphasize prevention. So presumably we're not just talking about a tactical response to a threat, say, to a premises or a building or a location, but also, I guess, the intelligence gathering, seeking the bomb factories and so forth. Is your neighbor a bomb maker? That sort of thing. Can you elaborate a little bit on your thinking along those lines?
The Israeli tactics... first of all, let's talk about the strategy. The strategy is very clear. Terrorism is aimed to make your life so miserable that you won't be able to get up in the morning and go out to work and send your children to school. And because the people that use these tactics believe that they can't win on a regular battlefield, they want to make you fearful and want to change the political agenda using that strategy. And of course, the way that the strategic answer is going on and living a normal life. Because when you live a normal life, the other side fails. And that's basically the strategy, and that's the first mission of the police, to make it possible for the Israeli people to live a normal life. When I came here to the United States, it was short after the a sniper here in Montgomery County. And a lot of colleagues asked me, what kind of people are you in Israel? We had one sniper, and for 3 weeks, life stopped. You have terrorist attacks for so many years, and you go on living. And I say, we exactly the same people. If you lived here in Montgomery County, you knew that the police will catch the sniper after a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So it makes perfect sense to keep low and wait until the police arrest the guy. When you live in the Middle East, it's not going away. It has been there for 120 years, and unfortunately, it's going to be for a while. So we can't wait to live. So we have to live our life every day, and that's the main role of the Israeli police, and we do it through various of tactics. As far as the United States is concerned, I don't believe you are in the same situation at the moment that we are, and I don't think we have to spread panic in the United States. These things have a self-fulfilling prophecy. What I think is actually not to try and make you live the way we live in Israel. I think the major advice that I give my colleagues here is to have plans in the drawer. Should the situation come, hopefully won't, but should it come, you won't waste the time that we took to invent the wheel, and you'll be very fast responsive to the situation. Unfortunately, I believe that the first round of attack, a good chance that some of them won't be prevented. The question is, and I think that's how the American people are going to judge the law enforcement here in the United States, is how long it's going to take the law enforcement to adjust from the first round of attacks to the second round of attacks. And that's why I preach for preparing a lot of plans and getting ready as far as the law enforcement, but not getting the population involved at this stage.
Well, one question that always comes up is the issue of profiling in this country. Is U.S. law enforcement capable of addressing that challenge? And how significant is it, in your judgment, that we have to have some sort of profiling instituted?
I don't believe profiling works. I don't think there's a profile for terrorism. We had suicide terrorists that were young and old, male and female, educated and uneducated, wealthy, poor. So I don't think profiling is the answer. I think that we use situational threat assessment. That's much more useful and much more helpful for us dealing with this topic.
Can you elaborate a little bit more about that approach?
Yes. When I talk, I can give you an example that over 20 years ago, a young English middle-class Caucasian pregnant woman came to the Al Al security in London, asking to fly to Israel. Her profile did not work, didn't meet any profile of someone that could be dangerous for the plane. And actually, she was not nervous because she was not aware that she was carrying a bomb. This lady actually was carrying a president from her lover, her Palestinian lover, to his family somewhere in the West Bank. She was not aware that this present was actually a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And while asking this lady, "Where are you going?" like everybody is asked, we found out that she was could not give sufficient answers. And at that moment, she was a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to do with her background, her race, education, her socio-economical situation. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It was at that moment her answers. It was suspicious. She created a threat at that stage, and that's why we decided, not me, of course,
mm-hmm.
the colleagues that were at that point, the security of Al Al, to check her. I think that's a great example
mm-hmm.
of
mm-hmm.
how you have to check the situation and not the profile.
Understood. Let's go back to your example about how we in the States suffered from IEDs and suicide bombings. In the Oklahoma City example, and well, actually the first World Trade Center attacks in 1993, perhaps not a suicide bomb incident, but they were vehicle-borne IEDs. In your judgment, how well are the police forces here prepared to deal with this particular threat?
It's you can't talk about one solution to such a problem. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a range of answers for such a situation. So I think it would be wrong to try and say, what does the policeman do if he sees a truck that he suspects, or
mm-hmm.
how will he know that this truck is suspicious? The answer is a system answer, not a private answer to a
mm-hmm.
solution. So I think you can't answer that question
mm-hmm.
with giving a good explanation.
Well, when we met first at the Mid-Atlantic All Hazards Forum last October in Baltimore, I recall you emphasized the importance of a speedy cleanup of a crime scene and the restoration of normality for public morale, and that's what you attested to earlier. Now, that must mean setting a balance against painstaking forensics collection. Is this point getting across to the U.S. authorities? I mean, how do you balance the need to establish public morale, the needs to establish evidence collection?
I don't think they're in conflict, in fact. I think what you have to do is treat the scene efficiently. So once there's a terrorist attack, and once the wounded and killed are evacuated, we come into the scene with a lot of people that work very professionally to gather evidence as far as forensic is concerned, and also bomb squad laboratories to try
mm-hmm.
to reconstruct the bomb, because there's a lot of information from
mm-hmm.
the bomb itself. And actually, we gather all the evidence and intelligence we need from the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But we do it with a lot of well-trained people. We don't come with one technician. We come with many technicians
mm-hmm.
that split the work, split the scene in a way that they can do it efficiently in a short time.
Mm-hmm. So the people in charge of the evacuation, they're pretty clear on how they can go about their business as expertly as possible without disturbing the crime scene, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's all in the training.
Absolutely.
The two teams are working pretty
closely. Unfortunately, besides training, a lot of experience.
Yes. I want to talk a little bit more now about the organizational response to the suicide bomber and the IED threat. Can we talk a little bit about balancing the various law enforcement agencies, transport police, state and harbor police? I don't know whether the paradigm works in the Israeli context, but obviously we've got a number of different law enforcement authorities with overlapping jurisdictions. Do you have any insights that might apply in the case of if an incident happened in Baltimore, where you've got the Harbor Police, the Maryland Transport Police, State Police, National Guard, how you you organize and structure both prevention and a response if something should happen?
Again, that question exactly meets the point that I said that we're not here to teach anything. We just share our experiences, and we think that you can translate our experiences into your structures. We, as I always say, we were visited by the Brits a few years after you were, and we have very English-like institutions. In Israel, we have only one law enforcement, and like I said, because we are so small, it's much easier to coordinate, and it's always police that runs the show, and it's always one commander responsible, because you can't have two commanders, and you can't split responsibility and authority. So I know this question is thought a lot about in the United States, because you have so many law enforcement organizations and so many official organizations. I know that American colleagues are aware of this necessity and they're dealing with it. And one of the things that I told you that, for example, in Maryland or in Ohio, Ken Morkel is putting together, like Dennis Schrader, like other colleagues, putting together the work, try to coordinate between the different organizations that are involved in the Homeland Security. So I think a lot of work is being done around this area. I know that in New York they're looking very closely into it. So things have been done. I don't think there's a perfect solution yet, because it is a very complicated issue, but there's a lot of change in the last few years.
What can Israel tell us then about best practices in intelligence gathering and analysis? I'm particularly taken with the hearing a lot these days about intelligence-led policing, which is something that began in Europe. And by that I mean it's a culture change for the U.S. law enforcement authorities that have been more traditionally focused on evidence collection for criminal prosecution. But if we're looking to prevent terrorist incidents, we're really looking at intel. Can you talk a little bit about some observations you have from the Israel experience?
In Israel, the policing has been intelligence oriented for a long time. The intelligence that the classic police does is intelligence that in the end of the day should produce evidence. And that in the regular classic law enforcement duties. But we believe that if you want to prevent terrorist attacks, you need to have very good intelligence, and you have to have very good operational capabilities to stop the attacks before they start, at the planning stages, at the preparation stages. And I think that is why we succeed today. And I think the statistics for the last half year is about 97% success stopping suicide terrorists. So just in the last year, we had over 100 attempts of last half year, I'm talking about last 5.5 months, we had more than 100 attempts of people to explode, and we had only 3 cases. So I think the intelligence is very important, and intelligence should be shared. And in Israel, we share intelligence between the 4 organizations that are security organizations. It has to be in real time, and it doesn't belong to any specific person. It belongs to the people, and it's aimed to protect people.
Do you think in the United States the local law enforcement has the resources to recognize the anomalies that would indicate if a suicide bomber handlers and surveillance teams, for example, may be operating in their jurisdictions? If not, how do you think they can come up with the right approaches?
I know that on from the federal level and the state and local level, there's a lot of awareness of that. And actually, when we take these groups to Israel, we take groups of ranking leaders from these organizations, and they do have a lot of conversations among themselves to try and improve the intelligence exchange. We had a group, it's funny because every time we go, at one stage the people say, wait a second, now we need to talk among ourselves, and the federal people talk to the state people, talk to the local people. And I think there's a lot of change in the United States. I don't know if it came to the idyllic position or situation. I think there's still a lot to do, But I think a lot of change has been done in the last 3 years.
Let me turn a little bit to talking about preparedness as it translates to procurement decisions. What sort of technology and equipment requirements do you see shaking out of this evolving threat for the local law enforcement agencies? Any insights as to new technologies that are coming online if you're a procurement official for a state or local law enforcement authority? What should you be looking at?
We use a lot of technology in Israel and in various areas, and we share this information with colleagues here in the United States. Actually, we have some combined programs. One of them, a very important one, with the NIJ, National Institute of Justice, which we have combined programs to produce such technologies together to deal with homeland security. This program has been going very successfully for the last 2 years. And I know that NIJ gives a lot of help on the federal level, but also in the state and local level. And I think that, as far as the United States is concerned, that's a very good point to make contact, to find out what capabilities, technological capabilities are out there. DHS has a very big department dealing with technology and developing technology. The defense ministry here also is quite involved, and we have combined programs. So there's a lot of information available from the federal level for local organizations. I do suggest actually to make contact to these organizations. If I was a chief of a local policing anywhere in the United States, I would call these organizations or directly to NIJ or going through the Homeland Security of the state to DHS, because they have very good contact with DHS. I think there's a lot of capabilities around, and unfortunately they're quite costly, some of them, but it's a force multiplier.
Well, for our last segment, I have a couple of questions. I want to talk a little bit about law enforcement liaison with the private sector. In Baltimore last October, you stressed how Israel has optimized the public and private sector approaches to suicide bomber countermeasures. In your view, how important is liaison between law enforcement and the private sector in this country, in the United States?
I think it has tremendous importance. I mean, there's no way that law enforcement can deal with internal security without private security and without the public. In Israel, we have 75,000 volunteers for the Civil Guard. It's three times larger than the police force itself. Of course, not all of them come every day. Some of them come just once a month. But it's tremendous help for the police. I think we wouldn't be able to function without them. Of course, this private security is very important. As you know, in Israel, in front of every restaurant, every building, every private or government installation, we have private security guarding the place, making sure that people don't bring bombs. Unfortunately, quite a few private security people in Israel, especially in front of malls, paid with their lives to prevent terrorists from penetrating. The concept of private security is very important. You have to understand that sometimes, as best as intelligence you have, as best as operational capabilities you have, you can't prevent the terrorist attack. And in that case, you have to do what we call damage control. Make sure that if this individual is going to explode, make sure that it doesn't explode inside a building, because the damage will be 10 times more, and to minimize damages. And I think in Israel, the relation between the police, which overlooks the activities of private security and the private security, is very important.
I imagine actually the countermeasures in this country would be a real challenge, because with the private sector companies that are in charge of the malls and the shopping centers and what have you now, restaurants, that's a big challenge. Are we anywhere near where we should be? And the linkages between local law enforcement and the private sector concerns, the or security companies that are assisting in the security for the large shopping malls.
Actually, in Israel, that's one of the topics I was talking about, having planned in the draw. American people are not and should not be at the state that they have to be checked when they go into the mall. But hopefully it won't happen. But if it would happen and people will explode inside a mall, immediately the malls, the private security, the restaurants will have to organize themselves. And I want to tell you that it's pretty weird, but the malls in Israel made tremendous amount of profit when security was going decreasing, because the Israeli people preferred coming to a protected mall and spending their money going to see movies, eating in malls, spending the day with the family, because it was a safe place, because they knew that outside it was more dangerous. So actually, the malls spent tremendous amount of money on security, but they love every cent that they spend because they're making much more, especially when things are hectic and problematic.
Well, Brigadier, thanks for taking time with us. Before we sign off, do you have any parting words of insight that you might want to share with our audience?
I hope that the American people won't have to go through what we are going in Israel. I'm not that optimistic about it. I think that unfortunately the world, and I'm talking about United States, I'm talking about Europe, I'm talking about the Middle East, is going through great changes. And in the long run will prevail, of course. But I think in the short run, we are not at the peak of the problem yet. And I do think that the role of law enforcement, and history will judge law enforcement by the way they organize themselves ahead of time to be responsive in time and not and save lives in the future.
Well, Brigadier, thanks again for hosting us and sharing your insights with our DonPrep members. We wish you every continued success in your career and your important work. Thanks very much.
Thank you.